Good morning and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, June 17th, 2000. This morning in the Creekside Room, Jeannie Olson is presenting a session entitled Being Comfortable with the Uncomfortable. This is session OLJ 2000-3. Let's listen in.
And how many of you were not here yesterday? So I can, okay. Well then,
not in this session.
They kind of go together in some respects. What I did yesterday is I kind of told the framework about being comfortable with the uncomfortable and being with and being present with people who are dying at a little bit more distance than actually the time that they're in their transition from this world to the next. And today, one of the things I'm going to do is concentrate on that actual time when people are actually dying and how to be present with them and help them through that. And of course, this is a real death-denying age that we live in. In fact, somebody said to me at the breakfast counter this morning, I didn't go to your class yesterday because I'm in denial of death and having to go to your class would be, you know, much too uncomfortable. And, you know, I mean, he said it kiddingly, but in all of that, I mean, there is a bit of truth in the way we as Americans live our life. And yet, you know, the theme is heirs of the promise. And to get to the ultimate promise, of course, is we have to die to get to the promised land. Today we're just going to kind of talk a little bit about that. How many of you have a will? Just raise your hands if you have a will. Okay. How many of you have a living will or a durable power of attorney for healthcare issues? Thank you. Okay. Sometimes called advance directives. Okay, anybody else want to raise their hand? I mean, that's another way to see how much we are in denial. If I have a chance to at the end of this session, or if anybody wants to talk about it another time, I really believe that not only is a will important, but everybody should have advance directives, and we could talk about that at a later time or at the end of this. That document is so important in end-of-life decisions, and you can get caught in traps that are just absolutely awful without having that particular document. So we can talk about that. But that is another piece of evidence that people are death-denying if they don't have those pieces of paper. Too often, it seems like in our modern society, we turn over that time of death to medical people, to the hospitals, to the nursing homes. And of course, those are important institutions because they do give care that is absolutely necessary. And yet, it sometimes deprives us of that opportunity to walk someone home. And now's my time to plug the two books that I have asked that be in the library. One is May I Walk You Home, which is listed right there. And I love the metaphor that these two women use. You know, in days gone by when we didn't have automobiles, people, when they would have a gathering at church or at school, would walk somebody home, you know, without the cars. And during that time of walking someone home, you would discuss the events of the that you were just at. You would discuss your views of life. You could be silent with one another. You could share stories about things that were important to you. And so you had that intimate time. And sometimes on that walking home, you did more intimate sharing because you weren't in the group that you just came from at the ice cream social at church. And of course, in conversation, when there's just two people, things are said that you'd never say in a large crowd. So I love the metaphor that they have used. And this little book says, it's courage and comfort for caregivers of those who are very ill. And it gives a little story, and it gives a kind of a prayer and a meditation at the end of it. It's a very good little book. I think they only have one left. And the other one that I plugged last night that I will plug again tonight is called Final Gifts. It's a wonderful book, stories by two hospice nurses who talk about their experiences with people who are dying. Wonderful book that I highly, highly recommend. The other metaphor that I like, besides walking someone home, is the metaphor of being a midwife to someone. Now, those of us who have given birth, or those of you who have been with someone who's given birth, how important that coach is, that midwife is, to help us through that process of giving birth. And I'll never forget, and I'm going to tell that story about the first time I was ever called a midwife. And it just kind of, I didn't know what she was talking about. But the more I thought of that as a metaphor for it, what a beautiful thing to be there, to be present, to be reassuring, to be encouraging in that experience of giving life into the next world. So that's another metaphor that we're going to use. And what a privilege it is to be in a delivery room, and what a privilege it is to be on that sacred ground when someone moves from this world to the next. I think I would like to start with, and for those of you who weren't here yesterday, some of the things we talked about was alleviating the fears of the people who are around the bedside, and alleviating the fears of the people who are dying, being reassuring, allowing them, giving them permission to go, affirming them as children of God if they are, in fact, people who are of that religious persuasion, whether they're Jewish or Christian or whatever, to know their religious beliefs and be able to then use those words to help them. And I'm not going to go into any more of what I covered yesterday. The first story I want to tell you is probably the saddest bedside scene I was ever at. And it was before I was a chaplain. A friend of mine, not a close friend, but a friend, had been told that she had cancer. And because she was part of a very charismatic prayer group, she took her breast cancer to the prayer group and wanted to be healed by prayer alone. Now, I believe in prayer, but I believe also you use it in conjunction with being smart enough to go to your medical doctor. But she took it only to her prayer group, and they prayed for her in a variety of ways, and her cancer got worse. Then she went to a hospital in the Chicago area that dealt most exclusively with nutrition and herbs and vitamins. Oh, I totally believe in that also. But again, that was the method she was using, and it progressed and metastasized even worse. So when she came back, she had to have a mastectomy, but it had metastasized to the bones. When I went to visit her, I was told, Jeannie, don't mention anything about death, because she still believes that God is going to heal her miraculously, and what a testimony that is going to be for her faith in God. I walked into the room, and by this time she was in a hospice unit where she was dying. And I walked in, and she was in a bed, and it was as if it reminded me of Jacob when he was struggling, you know, with death and with the enemy or whatever he was struggling with, because she was thrashing around the bed as if she was fighting against the angel of death. And as I looked at her family, what I saw and heard were people saying, Mom, it's okay. It's just a bump in the road. Yes, you're going to get better. It's okay. Your God is here, etc., etc., etc. She died of that cancer, never having accepted that she was going to die, never having talked about it with her family, them never having the opportunity to say goodbye and to do the things that would have made for a peaceful death. And as I watched that family at the funeral and at the visitation and afterwards, as I kind of followed them, I saw that this was one of the most unhealthy family situations of grief that I had seen. And I felt for them. And I didn't know anything then of what I know now, but I just knew, whoa, this wasn't a good thing. And I struggled with that. But as I became a chaplain and saw how things could be so different, and none of my parents have died. I haven't had brothers or sisters to have died. So I only speak to you as a chaplain in a hospital. For those of you who weren't here yesterday, I've been a hospital chaplain for 15 years. And I feel that it has been a privilege to be at the bedside of people. But I don't say that
that I haven't had the experience of the loss of a parent or a child or a brother or a sister. So I don't know what that feels like, though I've had two best friends die in the last year. And those experiences have affected me profoundly. I want to tell you the story about Julie. Julie was a young mom who was in her mid-30s. She had two darling children and a very wonderful, loving, and attentive husband. And Julie said, when I get better, when I get rid of this cancer and am back well on my feet, I'm going to come back to this oncology floor. And I'm going to help other young moms through this because I know what it's like to have your health taken away and have to go through chemotherapy and lose your hair and not be there to do the mom things that we like to do as moms. Well, the sad news is that Julie didn't make it and she died. And she died in room 4412, and that is an important piece in this. A couple of months after Julie died, we had a patient by the name of Linda, who was in her late 30s and the mom also of two young children. They were perhaps 10 and 12. Linda was absolutely furious that she was dying. She was so angry. She was angry at God. She was angry at cancer. She was angry. And as the anger increased, she continued to push away people that were part of her life. She pushed away her brothers and sisters, her parents, her children. Even her spouse felt estranged and disconnected from her. She didn't get along with the staff. She didn't want to work with anybody. She had told her pastor not to come. Well, she was in room 4415, which is right across from the nurse's station. Because she was a patient that needed a lot, they wanted her close so they could be near her and help her. But they felt that because they knew she was dying, they wanted to give her a bigger room. Now, 4412, it used 20 years ago, 30 years ago, they used to put the dying patients at the end of the hall because they didn't want to deal with them, and they didn't want other patients to see that there were patients in their hospital dying. And so they were on the end of the hall. But in our oncology floor, we had what we called the Hilton room because it was a bigger room. It had two walls of windows that we were on the fourth floor, and so it looked out on trees and sky and a wonderful view of the city. And it had a bigger bathroom, it had a bigger room, and so family members could be in there. And you were close enough to the nurse's station that people could hear you if you called, but people didn't walk by because it was kind of in a corner, and so you weren't on the pathway that people walked by. So the family decided to move Linda into that room, like around 10 o'clock at night, after her husband had left. Well, around 2 o'clock in the morning, she started screaming at the top of her lungs. And the nurses went running in, and she said, I don't want to be in this room anymore. There's too many dead people in this room. There's too many dead people in the room. I'm scared. I don't want to be in here. We had never told Linda that that's what that room was often used for, and it wasn't just used for that. We didn't tell her that. Linda, no problem. You know, your other room is still empty. We'll take you back to your room. That night, while the nurses in the nursing evening shift were working at their desks, a pot of flowers that was sitting and wildflowers were sitting in this vase, and the pot of flowers moved all the way down the nurse's station to the other end, while two nurses and an aide sat there watching, thinking someone was playing a trick on them, and it was kind of a low, it wasn't one of those high ones, it was a low thing. They ran around the side, and there was absolutely no one there. They went, oh my gosh. Well, the next morning, Linda's husband came to see her. And he walked in, and the nurses had said, your wife kind of had a bad night. We moved her to another room, and she didn't like the room, and so we moved her back. But she had a tough night. So he walks in, and he said, well, I hear you had kind of a tough night. She said, yes, I did. I was in another room, and I didn't like that room. There were too many dead people in that room. But then she took this big sigh, and she said, but I'm fine now. He said, well, good. Well, what happened? And he said, well, Julie came to see me. And her husband said, "Who's Julie?" And he said, she said, "Well, Julie came to see me, and I don't care." She said, "Well, honey, you know, is that some friend of yours from work, or a nurse, or who's Julie?" She said, "Julie came, and I'm fine now. Please bring the children this afternoon." And he went out to the nurse's station. He goes, "Who came to see my wife this morning?" And the nurses said, "No one has been in your wife's room. We didn't let any of the staff in. We didn't let people who wanted to come and get blood in. She hasn't had any friends. It's only 8 o'clock in the morning. We made sure that her drawer was closed and she wasn't disturbed because she got so little sleep in the night when we had to move her." He said, "Well, she said that Julie came to see her and she seemed so much more at peace." And their eyes, of course, got huge because they had all been talking about the vase that moved. And they said, "I think we'll get the chaplain." So that's what I got called up. And I was told all of these stories. And so I took Linda's husband, Don, aside and I said, "I can't explain to you for sure what happened, but I'm going to tell you what I think happened. I want to tell you about Julie." And I said, I explained this whole thing. And I said, "Julie said she was going to come back and help young moms." And I said, "Nobody else was in your wife's room this morning, but we'll see what happens." And I Xeroxed the chapter in this book that talked about people coming to visit people, people who have died coming to visit people who need help in this transition and need to know how to cope with this. And so I Xeroxed the chapter. And what's interesting is that Linda's personality changed from that morning on. Not only did she call in her children and start to work with them in saying goodbye, but she called back in her parents and she called back in her friends. And about a week and a half later, with total peace that she had experienced through this week and a half, Linda was able to let go and say goodbye in a peaceful manner to her family. Again, as I said yesterday, you know, you can't prove any of these things. All you can do is know that there's a spiritual side of what goes on in a hospital and in a place where people are dying that we can't explain. All we can do is accept it, rejoice in it, and be thrilled that someone has come to peace with their having to let go. Debbie is the other story, another story I want to tell you. Debbie was a 23-year-old. She had a 4-year-old daughter, and the first day I met her, she had cancer, and she said, "Jeannie, I want to live long enough that my 4-year-old daughter remembers me." At that point, the lump was so big in my throat that I thought, you know, how can we help to do that? Well, she struggled and worked and came into the hospital a variety of times, in and out, with the doctors giving her chemotherapy, but you could see that she was on a slippery slope. She didn't have a husband, but she had two wonderful, loving parents that helped her through this process. Well, the last time she came into the hospital, she was so thin that you could see every bone in her body. I mean, she was like a concentration camp victim. And every Friday, I would go in and say goodbye to her. It was one of the last things I did because I was sure that Monday morning she would not be there. And I would come back on Monday morning and she was there. I mean, she was the most determined person I'd ever seen. And this happened for 5 Fridays. And finally, I was going to Arizona for a vacation. I was going to be gone for a week. And so I went and said goodbye to her. And while I was in Arizona, I read Final Gifts. And I came back and Debbie was still living. By this time, she was so thin that you could see into the eye sockets of her eyes. That's how thin she was. And she couldn't talk very well anymore. And I met her mother in the hall after I had gone in to see her and saw how dreadful she looked. And I said to her mother, "Do you think there's something that's holding Debbie back from letting go? Because she seems like she's done everything she needs to do, but like there's something we're missing." And her mother said, "I can't stand to watch her suffer anymore. I can't stand it. And I wish she would just let go. But how do you tell someone, please go? I mean, it sounds rude." And I said, "Well, do you think we could just ask her?" Now, I would have never had the guts to ask anyone had I not read this book. She said, you do it. I can't do it, and I can't bear to be there. You do it. So I walked in, and this skeleton but beautiful woman was sitting in a chair using a little green sponge on her mouth, sitting up. And I said, Debbie, I said, I don't know if I've ever met a braver woman in my life, one who has worked harder, fighting for her life, and doing all the right things so little Letitia will remember her. I said, you've taken pictures, you've written her a letter, you've given her memories. I said, you've done all the right things. I said, I know you're a person of faith. You believe in an afterlife. You believe in a God who's with you. You pray. You know that that transition is going to come and you've worked through that. You're at peace. I said, is there something we're missing that you can't let go and that we need to do for you or help you with? And she answered me, and I missed it. Couldn't get it because her voice was so soft. I said, say it again. I'll try and get it this time. And I missed it again. Couldn't get it. So I handed her a piece of paper and I said, please write it down. And she wrote, they're bringing her. And by this time her mother had come in and was sitting next to me on the floor. And I said, you mean Letitia, your daughter? She said, yes. And I looked at her mom because I knew that they hadn't brought Letitia because Debbie looked absolutely awful. And it would have been horrifying for this 5.5-year-old to look at her mother like that. And I said, getting Debbie's mother's permission, I think your parents haven't brought Letitia because this illness hasn't been kind to you. And the beautiful Debbie that you have always been, this disease has been unkind, and you're so very thin that we thought that it would be frightening for Letitia. And she leaned back in her chair, and I said, but if you need to see her, looking at the mother, trying to get permission for all this as I'm saying this, if you need to, we will bring Letitia and we'll prepare her for this. And she leaned back and she sighed and she said, no, now I understand. And within 24 hours, she let go. But without that book, or without having read that sometimes we have to go ahead and ask the questions of what people need because we may be missing it without asking it. Sometimes people are much more upfront with what they need. Because I work in an area that's extremely emotional, and I'm sure many of you do too, we as chaplains know that we have to debrief what we do, because otherwise we get burned out. One of the reasons I work on a 10-month contract is so that I don't have to think about this for 2 months, which is one of the ways that I can keep doing it. But the other way on a daily basis is that all of the chaplains know that they can go to another chaplain and sit down and say, I need to talk about this. I need to debrief this. I need to let it go. And what we do, and I'm going to be talking next week about our befrienders. Our befrienders are our trained volunteers that go in and listen to stories. And they cannot leave the hospital until they've written up their visit, until they've debriefed with one of us chaplains. Because it's not fair to ask them to walk out carrying all of these heavy-duty stories with them and not knowing what to do with that. So they turn them over to us. And then knowing that, first of all, they give us referrals of patients that we need to get back to. Because in my area alone, I have like 200 beds. So they give me referrals of people to see, but also so that they can share this and get rid of the stories. Sometimes, if there isn't somebody there, I write out the stories because I have to get them out somehow. And so when I came down from this particular situation, I just sat down at the typewriter and wrote it out because there wasn't anything else for me to do. The one time I didn't do that, I had the first time I was a chaplain that someone died in my arms. And I had never had anyone do that before, but the only person who was present was the daughter. And she said, "I can't be in there when mom dies. Will you go in there and be with her?" And having never done that before, I figured, well, you know, I'll figure out what to do as I'm going along. And so I did this, and I'll share that story another time. But I was so upset, and there wasn't anyone in my department for me to debrief with. And I remember waking my husband up at midnight and saying, "I got to talk about this. I can't sleep until I talk about this." And so poor Paul had to wake up at midnight and hear my story. I've learned not to carry some of that home. It's not fair to my husband. So this I'm just going to sort of read to you in this situation. I'm also, as I'm telling you these stories, I want you to know that I'm not sharing these stories because I think I'm an authority on this. I'm sharing these stories only as examples of ways to do this, and not saying that this is the only way by any means, because everybody has to use how they use their talents and use their abilities in any given situation. Okay, this story is, the nurse was in ICU called me and said, she's only 52 years old. She's dying of heart and lung problems. She's a do not resuscitate. She wants to talk, and her son and her husband are with her. I entered in and introduced myself. She looked up between difficult breaths and said, "I can't go on anymore. It's just too hard." "You've been through a lot," I said, and I took her hand. "Yes, and I'm too tired to fight anymore." Her husband and her son nodded, reaffirming her long, hard struggle. And then they talked about her illness and all of its history, because she didn't have the strength to do that. "I just want to die. Judy, we will do everything we can to make this easy for you," I said. "And what do you need to be able to die peacefully?" She thought for a moment and she said, "I need to talk to my four children and my father." I nodded to her husband, "Can you arrange that?" He nodded, "Yes." "And what do you need from them?" This is an unbelievably insightful statement from her. "I need them to give me their blessing that my dying is okay, and that they will let me go." How old was she?
52.
Of course they didn't want to let her go. She's young. So very insightfully, she knew that she would have to keep struggling and working to live if they weren't going to let her go. I looked at both her husband and her eldest son, and they both nodded, but with tears in their eyes. "Judy, your husband will arrange for your family to come." She seemed to relax a bit, but was still tense. I knew that such and such a Methodist church was listed as her church. "Is there a pastor you would like to call from your church?" I said. "We don't know him very well. He's new." We went on to discuss how helpful it would be to have him come at this time, because he would be doing her service and needed to get to know her, obviously. But she was still extremely tense. So I said, "Are you afraid, Judy, of what lies ahead?" She nodded and she grabbed my other hand. I said, "Would you like me to share with you what may happen to you as you approach your transition from this world to the next?" She nodded. I then shared with her the physical slowdown of her body, how the nurses and doctors would do everything they could to keep her comfortable and free from pain, and finally how her spirit would lift from her body. I asked her who had died previous to her and who therefore would be there to greet her. She smiled as she named her mother and a son. I asked her if I could pray a prayer of a peaceful transition for her, and she nodded yes, and we made a circle with her husband and her son, and I prayed, putting all this in the prayer. She then laid her head back on her pillow and sighed. She seemed to relax for the first time. "I'm tired now," she said, and she closed her eyes. I knew she was dismissing me. I turned to her husband and I said, "May I suggest that we ask for a private room up on the floors?" Remember, she was in intensive care. "So that you and your family, your whole family, may have more room, more privacy, without the clanging and banging and rat race of the ICU. "Yes, that would be much better," they said. "There's many of us." I went out to call the pastor and talk to the charge nurse to find a room upstairs. I am told Judy died peacefully 1.5 days later in a private room surrounded by her family. Judy knew what she needed, and she was direct enough to ask for it. I think that I have found, working with families, that people will hang on until that one last person gives permission. And what's interesting is usually it's the person from out of town who can't let go. Why? Well, a variety of reasons. One is they haven't been there to see the journey that this person perhaps has been on, if it's been a long-term illness, the cancer, the AIDS, the chronic lung disease, the slowing down of the body, the losing of their faculties and of their abilities to relate, of their physical slowdown and not being able to eat perhaps and so, talk and so on. So they've missed some of that. Some of the time it's guilt. The rest of the family was here to take care of Mom, but I've been here living in such and such a place and haven't been there, and I feel guilty about that. And sometimes it is that they just haven't had enough time to say goodbye. And they need time to be alone with Mom or Dad or whoever it is to share and say goodbye and say what they haven't had to have chance to say before, what they haven't had a chance to say. And so they need that time. And finally, when that last person can say, "Okay, okay." And that's why I, as a chaplain, really try and help families orchestrate, making sure that everybody gets time alone. Now, I know when I walk into a room as a chaplain, that a patient will talk to me honestly only when no one else is in the room. Why do they do that? Because that's the only time that they're not protecting, oftentimes, their loved ones. They'll say, "You know, I'm really afraid of," or, "So-and-so really can't let me go," or, "This is one of the things that my family won't talk about." But they'll tell a total stranger. And it has amazed me for 15 years what people will tell a total stranger. Number one, maybe because they trust us, but number two, because we don't have any history with them. And they're not protecting us the way they protect their loved ones. The other thing that I want to say and interject before the next story is that many times a family will sit vigil for weeks, hours. People will only leave to go take a shower and get a cup of coffee or run down to the cafeteria and get food and bring it up. And then what happens is that the person dies when they've run to go do this. And yet they have spent, like I said, weeks at the hospital. And then the person or the family members will beat themselves up. "Why wasn't I here? Why did I leave? Why did I go get a copy? I should have been there. I promised them I would be there." And I tell them this, and I'll ask them this. Was your loved one, your family member, your spouse, Henry here, was he the sort of person who always wanted to take care of you? Was he sort of always doing gentle, nice things, loving things to you? "Well, yeah, that's exactly what Henry was like." Well, do you think maybe that he did that on purpose? so that you didn't have to have your last picture of him dying, but that so that you could remember him living, and that he might have thought that it was just too hard for you to be there in those final moments because he thought it would be either difficult to watch or that he just didn't want you to have that memory. And that's one of the reasons that I love the name of this book, Final Gifts. Because I say to people, you know, I think it's the last gift he wanted to give you. And we reframe the whole thing, that it isn't, I should have been there, I let them down, but this was a gift that he or she wanted to give you. It's hardest, however, when it's children. And children have said to me, you know, this is really hard on my parents. I don't think they can do this. And it's hardest because those, you know, mom, dad there, and then that child slips away. I tell them this story and hoping that then they don't beat themselves up for the rest of their lives for having not been there. Carol's story is the last story I'm going to tell you. And then I would like to open it up for you to share any stories, feelings, questions, responses, anything. This is one that I wrote up, and I can't even read my own writing on this story. I didn't have a typewriter or a computer or anything to write it on. I think I was at home. And I've never really rewritten it. There's something about having that first draft that's somehow special. So I will sort of half tell, half read this story. And this is the one that I was with the person right as they were going, moving over, crossing over to the promised land. And I'm just going to sort of read this also and tell it. And again, it's just a story. It's not the perfect story. It's not the perfect transition. It's what I happen to do one day. Janet, the RN, called me and told me to stop by and see Carol. She was dying. She isn't responding, Janet said. She may have had a stroke. She's in a coma or she's in a semi-comatose state. Her husband's there. Her parents are there. Carol's 47 years old. She has advanced cancer. She's a do not resuscitate. I hadn't known Carol previous to this. Luckily enough, she had been able to stay out of the hospital and had most of her treatment at home. As I walked in her room, her mother was stroking her forehead. Tell me about Carol, I said, because I believe it's important to share stories about people. And because I believe that people can hear, even though they're in a comatose or semi-comatose state, even though they don't respond, I always tell family members, talk to them, talk to them. Hearing is the last thing that goes. Talk to them, because even though they can't respond to you, there's a good chance they can hear you. So I said, tell me about Carol. So I knew that I would, and I was hoping she could hear this, but I also wanted to know who Carol was, because like I said, I knew nothing. So she told me about stories about Carol, about who she was, about her family, about her children, about her faith, about her Catholicism, about her journey, and about her illness. Her father came in, next her brother came in, her husband came into the room, and all of a sudden Carol became extremely agitated, and she was moving about, and she was thrashing, and her head was going back and forth, and her eyes were open, but they were kind of glazed over, and they had this look of fear, and and she was making this guttural sound in the depths of her throat that she was indicating like she was trying to talk, but it was absolutely no words at all. And the nurse came in and was trying to give her something in her IV to calm her down, and that wasn't working at all. And her mother was trying to talk to her, and her mother was getting frustrated, and everything was just escalating. Her husband came in and tried to take her hand and talk to her, and that wasn't working, and she was getting more and more and more agitated. Her mother said, I just don't know what to do. And I said, would you like me to talk to Carol? She said, oh, please. So I walked up to Carol and I said, Carol, I know this isn't easy. In fact, I know it's very hard. I took her hand and moved closer to her. You are having trouble breathing and you are feeling scared. but your nurse, Mary Lou, is here, and she's going to put something in your IV that's going to make you feel better. You will rest easier. The shot will make you feel less stressful. You may feel a little sleepy. But as I'm looking at Mary Lou, she's telling me it's not working, the thing isn't going in for whatever reason, and she couldn't even explain what was going on. And then she looked at me like, this isn't going to work. This is her time, we're losing her. And I turned to her mother and I said, I think this is Carol's time. Do you want to talk to her? Mother said, no. I said, would you like me to? And she said, yes. Carol, pretty soon your breathing will get slower and slower. You will feel like you're drifting away from us. And all of a sudden you will take one breath in this world and one breath in the next. And you will have made the transition. You'll leave this earthly body and you'll leave pain behind. You'll leave this labored breathing. You'll leave cancer. You'll move to freedom. Now, as I was saying this and talking to her, her head started to slow as in this thrashing motion, and all of a sudden it stopped as I was talking to her, but it was still held back. As a Catholic, I bet you learned about angels when you were a child, and I looked at her mother to see if I was in fact telling truths, and her mother nodded yes. And I bet you know that you had a guardian angel that watched over you your entire lifetime. Now her head was moving, and it was way back like this, and it was moving down. And that guardian angel has been watching you your entire lifetime and is here now to escort you to your new home. You may see a bright light, and you may be drawn to it because you are being drawn to the love of God. And now she's taken her head, and I'm on the side of her bed, and she's turned her head, and she's looking straight at me. I know you don't want to leave this family behind. Your husband is here, your father, your mother. Your loved ones are here. You'll need to leave this family, but you will be going to meet those who have died before you. They will be there to welcome you, and you'll be home to your new heavenly home. She's continuing to look at me. So, Carol, I'm going to touch your forehead and remind you of your baptism. You were signed and sealed with the cross of Christ at your baptism. You were declared His with this sign, and I took and made the sign of the cross on her forehead. You can rest in that peace as God's child. Don't be afraid. It will be easier than you think. I hesitate to call it death, Carol. By now I'm stroking her face. Because you don't end, you simply move from one world to the next. And she's looking at me intently this whole time, and her father is there, and her mother, and her husband has left. I looked at Mary Lou, who's now taking her blood pressure, and Mary Lou indicates we're going to be losing her. So I continue saying the things that I've been saying. She continues to look at me. I continue to encourage her, and all of a sudden her eyes glass over and start to close, and her head falls to the side. And I turned around. By this time, tears are streaming down my face, and I turned to her mother, who is right next to me and has been holding her hand. And I embraced her mother, and her mother has tears flowing down her face. And her mother said, I've never seen anything quite like that. And I said, neither have I. And I went around and embraced her father and went to find her husband and did the appropriate things in that room and went to call the Catholic priest to come up and do what he needed to do. And as I walked by the nurse's station, the charge nurse and head nurse said, I hear you're a midwife. And I looked at her, and by that, I hadn't ever heard that word used in that context before, and I had no idea what she was talking about. And she could tell that, and she said, I hear you as a family midwifed her into the next world. Sort of clicked then, and I thought, what a wonderful metaphor for what happened in there. But as I walked down the hall and down to my office, I got angrier and angrier at myself. By the time I reached my office, I walked into my boss the manager of the department, who was my spiritual mentor, the director of the department, my CPE supervisor, my best friend next to Paul. And I walked in and I slammed the door and I said, it shouldn't have been me. Okay, back up, give me a clue of what you're talking about. And I explained the whole situation that went on in that room. And I said, I had never met Carol before. And yet, in her dying moments, it was me who was talking her through it. It shouldn't have been me. And wise Rick Johnson, the head chaplain, said, Jeannie, did I hear in that story that you asked permission from Carol's mother? I said, yes, I asked permission. Did I hear you say that the husband couldn't even handle being in the room, to say nothing of doing that with her? I said, yes. And she said, then it sounds to me like you were the one who needed to be there. I said, but more people need to know how to do that. So it's not just chaplains, and it's just not hospice nurses like in Final Gifts. Do that. And I've learned something today, and I want to read to you what I decided to do that very night. The final chapter in this book, most important, don't give in to the understandable temptation to be in the middle of this exciting communication. It is neither your right nor your honor, Jeannie Olson. Your role is to teach friends, family members, how to listen, how to understand, and respond appropriately to a dying person's message, and how to help other people know how to be there at that time. That's one of the reasons I put this thing together. We have CPE students, clinical pastoral education students, at our hospital. So we have approximately 12 student chaplains a year. So I put this together to teach them how to do that. Some of them are pastors, some of them are seminary students, some of them are doing some sort of Christian work. But then I also took it to our befrienders, and then I took it to the church, because I thought, again, everyone will be at the bedside sometime. And if there's one thing that can help, so that we can be present to our own loved ones in that sacred time. And I do believe being that midwife, being there to walk them home, is sacred ground. And how important for that loved one to be able to look into your eyes instead of the eyes of a chaplain or a hospice nurse. So I open it up. I have difficulty sharing these stories. So if you've had difficulty hearing them, I understand that. But if you have difficulty sharing the story, we understand that too, because this isn't exactly easy stuff. And that's why one of the titles is Being Comfortable with the Uncomfortable. This is uncomfortable stuff. But I open it up.
I would like to tell my most unique death and dying experience. I've had 22 years of nursing with the VA, and many years ago it was our policy that nobody died alone. If there wasn't family there, or if there was a lot of veterans, for some reason or other, there would be someone. So this one morning, I said, well, Joey, I'll be assigning you to Henry, and you know,
Henry's, can you hear?
Okay, Henry's not going to be with us too much longer. So, okay, I went in there. Well, Henry looked just kind of fine to me, except for his vital statistics. So I said, okay, Henry, let's do your bath. And all this. Okay, we'll do that. And this was a morning when Henry even washed his own face. And then kind of fluffed his pillow, settled him back, and all of a sudden he's looking at the door, and he's going, and this had been a cold, creepy, miserable day in South Dakota. But at this point, I thought, and it had been cloudy and dark, and I thought, oh, well, the sun must have come out, and the window was behind me. And I said, Henry,
And he didn't say anything to me. He was so intent looking at the door, going like this. Well, finally, I touched his shoulder and I said, Henry, tell me, who do you see? He patted my hand. He says, oh, sis, you know. And he slipped into unconsciousness.
He said, say that statement again.
He said,
you know.
Oh, sis, you know.
So, and then he went unconscious?
Uh-huh. Went unconscious and all probably, you know, really, respiration ceased and all that maybe within an hour. But I had known Henry through the last week or so of being there, and the chaplain had been around. We had talked about religion, we had talked about this, and so he was just so surprised that I hadn't seen whoever was, at the door with the light. And then I quickly looked around to the window, and it still was the cold, miserable cloudy day.
Wow.
So when
you were on sacred ground.
Oh, yes. And I thought, this is really cool.
Thank you for sharing that. It's a beautiful story. One of the reasons I want you to speak up is because I want the microphones to hear your stories also, if you're willing to have them taped. Ingrid.
When you said midwife, it reminded me that I was at Holden Village about 15 years ago, hiking in Copper Basin, and came down, and Elmer Witt, the then director, met us partway down and said, your best friend's husband was just killed, you need to go immediately to be with her. And so I did, and they were actually due up here on teaching staff a week later. It was sort of a funny connection, but I went up to Edmonton where this man had been killed very suddenly. He was running on the right path and a car ran off the road and hit him and knocked him into a ravine. And then I felt like for the next week I was midwifing the death for my best friend and her two daughters.
Oh yeah.
And I just climbed into bed with them and stayed with them. I mean, we arranged the funeral and we had to do all of that. But there needed to be somebody that was, and somehow I need a tremendous amount of sleep, and I'm really impossible without it. But somehow that week I didn't need sleep.
Wow.
And I just stayed with them and stayed with them and stayed with them. And it meant listening, talking, holding them when they sobbed, helping them with whatever they needed. But she invited me upstairs in the family house. Or she actually, their stairs went up halfway, and there was a room on the landing, and then went up the other half of the way, and the family bedrooms were upstairs. She asked me to stay in the room on the landing, and to prevent, it was sort of an inside-outside thing, she had a difficult family, her own extended family. She didn't want them upstairs. But I spent every night in bed with them, with my best friend and her two daughters. We talked and sobbed and did everything, but it seemed like somebody had to get inside there to help them. It took 8 days before I think they really realized that he was dead.
Yeah.
And got back on their feet in some sense and started to breathe it. And I stayed through that period and extended my stay a couple of extra days because I could see it was too early to leave. But that was another way of midwifing.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So it doesn't just necessarily have to be at that time, but midwifing through the grief process. That's a beautiful story.
It seemed almost like I was stepping into some ancient tradition that I knew nothing about. You know, it was like I knew what to do, thank God, through some other way. But it must be something that people have done for each other for generations.
There's a Greek term called parakaleo, and what parakaleo kind of means walking alongside. I mean, and that's what you did. You know, you just came up alongside of whatever they needed, you were there for. But you were also kind of protecting them from these other people who wanted to get it, but she just wanted you. I mean, that's what a beautiful, sacred space.
They wouldn't go see his body until I was there and lived with them. And then they wouldn't approach the body until I approached it with them.
Yeah.
So they just needed somebody who was standing outside, rooted maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe with some...
And that they trusted, and that they could be there for them in a loving, supportive way. I teach a class on the cliches people use at times of death and funerals. Oh my gosh, the people think, you know, people say, trying to be helpful. But, you know, somebody who can really be there and know what to do is just a gift. Absolutely a gift. A final gift. Stacy.
My grandfather died in 1993, and at that time my cousin was 6 or 7 years old, and my mom and her 2 sisters and brother and mother were lucky enough to be present the last 2 days with my grandfather by themselves, just sitting at his bed that was in the living room. He was dying of cancer. And my 6 or 7 year old cousin was back home in Minneapolis with his father and his other brother. And so he wasn't present for my grandfather's death. He came up later for the funeral. But within this last year, just this winter, my cousin, who is now 13 years old, told my aunt that he wanted to talk about grandpa's death, that he was there and he saw what happened. And my aunt told him, you know, you weren't there, you were in Minneapolis. And he said, no, I know what happened. And he described what the room was like that last night. He told my, he said where my aunt was sitting, that she was sitting on a stool at the end of the bed, and that she had reached for grandpa's feet, but, you know, he couldn't see her face from where she was sitting. He went into great detail. And he said, grandpa was purple, and he was standing behind you. There was this purple light that he could see. And that when he died, it went up in the air, this purple color of grandpa. And so my aunt knew at this point that he had seen something, because the details that she was sharing were way too detailed, something that she hadn't shared in the past 7 years, and no one went into details with that. And he talked about how the morticians had come later that night and were standing downstairs, and that one mortician stood in the hallway and the other one was talking to the family, and he could talk about all of that. And then he said that, and I've heard this part of the story over the past 7 years, that my mom and her siblings and my mother, or my grandmother, got up after the morticians had left and went for a walk in their bathrobes. It was in the middle of December. Got their coats on and went for a walk. And my little cousin told my aunt, when you went for a walk, there was a huge room. And my aunt remembers that room. And he said, that's when grandpa left.
And wow.
my aunt right now is wondering, what do you tell a 13-year-old to not discredit them and say, you've seen something incredible, but not say you're crazy? Because if you go to school and say something like that, someone's going to tell you you're crazy. He had a gift that...
Yeah, he was given a gift.
And so she's kind of at ends, not knowing what to do. He's an extremely artistic and insightful and intuitive person. And so if one person was to see these things, it's no surprise that it was him in a lot of ways.
What a beautiful story. Mm-hmm. You know, and obviously he saw that and was just given that as a gift to share it. And usually when people have experiences like that, you know, they don't need to prove it to anyone or whatever. They know they've had it and they know it's true. And how neat, though, that he was willing to, even after, what did you say, a year and a half?
Well, it took him 7 years to finally tell my mom.
7 years? Okay, yeah. I didn't hear that.
I mean, he was a young child, and it's just now that he's... And he's had a couple other incidents of things, similar things like this happening with other family members. So I think it was at that point that he shared that this had happened more than once.
Beautiful story. Thank you. Yeah.
My mother died a year ago May, and it was a situation where I lived 700 miles away and was coming back and forth a lot before she died, and we had two women who were spending a lot of time with her for like AIDS and knew her real well. The first thing that happened was several months before she died, I had called to see how she was doing, and they said, well, she's not quite with us today. We don't know what's going on. She keeps saying it's time to go from west to east.
Oh.
And I had read one of those books, like The Final Gifts. And so I got on the phone with her, and, you know, I asked her about it. And, you know, can you explain anything more about it to your mother? No, it's just time to go from west to east. And I said, okay, well, that's fine. And she was not doing well, so I got in the car and came over there and was there for a while. And particularly one of the women that was staying with her was very attached to her and was having a very hard time with the idea that she might die, you know. And so I spent time with the boys trying to encourage her that it was okay for mother to go. And we talked about, you know, this is possibly a symbol sort of thing. And then she was all right for a while. She got over the illness. She was, you know, doing okay. And then she got pneumonia. And I came back and was with her in the hospital then. And she was very ill for a long time. And then she had a day that was like she just had all kind of energy. And she was just alert. She was ready to get out of bed, leave the hospital, and go and do all this sort of thing. And the first thing that happened was I was trying to think of things to do, and I'd read a story from Guidepost magazine, and it happened to be about a woman dying. I didn't know it when I started it. It was set at Thanksgiving, and a little bit after that, she said, could you get my parents' phone number for me? Because her parents had been dead for years, you know. And I said, well, I don't know, Mom. It'd be kind of hard for me to do. Why do you want to get it? And she said, well, I need to let them know why I'm not here for Thanksgiving. And I said, oh, well, you know, maybe we can just let them know. You know, I think they will understand why you're not here, you know. And we did that several times that day. And then later in that afternoon, it was a Catholic hospital, and over to the left, there was a little crèche there in the wall, you know, and she, just like the story you were telling, she was just focused on that place, and I could see her just looking at me. So what is it, Mother? And she says, all the family is gathering. And I said, oh, really? She says, yes, they're out on the porch. And I said, what are they doing? She said, well, they're moving around. It's like she's looking and trying to figure out. They're moving around, and they're making a space. And I thought, oh, you know, like for you. I said, for you? And she said, no. She says, you know how we like to used to get together and play games and everything? And they're sitting at the table. And they're, you know, they're just circling around the table. I think they're going to, you know, get ready for some games. And then that was gone, and that was all that day. And again, she rallied again, and about 2 weeks later, I get a call, and they take me to the hospital again, and I'm going. And in the emergency room, one of our friends met her and said, you know, how are you doing, Jean? What's going on? She said, I'm not doing well. Why? What's wrong? I can't get through the door.
She was using lots of metaphors,
right. You know, what door? The double door, you know? Well, what's behind the door? God. And she died in a couple of days.
Wow. After that. Wow, how nice. That, were you here yesterday from the...
I didn't get here.
Okay,
yesterday.
But what, one of the things that you did with her, which was so beautiful, is that you didn't discount anything she said. You went ahead and used the metaphors that she was using so that you know, you affirmed her journey and her metaphors. I'm going to end the class now because it's time and it's soon time for lunch. If people didn't get a chance to talk but have stories they would like to share with me, one of the things I'm happy to do any time in the village is just sit down and talk with you. Or if you didn't just want to tell them in a public place like this but wanted to talk or had some questions or anything, I'd be glad to talk with any of you. Again, thank you for coming. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.